Welcome to the Non-Op series for the Minerals and Royalties podcast, where EMPs and drilling capital meet the minerals and royalties space.
Hey guys, this is Tim Powell from the Minerals and Royalties Authority. I recently sat down with Lex Hockner, Managing Director at Pickering Energy Partners. During the episode, Lex walks through Pickering's strategy in the non-op space, including their non-op PDP strategy and their non-op drilling strategy. Let's jump into the episode and hear more of what Lex had to say.
Lex, good morning and welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Tim. Appreciate you having us. We're excited for the chat.
You bet. So we've known each other for, you know, 6-7 years now through my previous life in Energy Council. But for those who don't know you, little context, where'd you grow up, go to school? Have you always been in the oil patch? Were you in finance and you went into the oil patch? Over to you to give some context.
Yeah, thanks. So born and raised here in Houston, Texas. Went to a small private school here in town, Kincaid. And then I went up to the Northeast for a period of time. I did my undergrad at Dartmouth. I really enjoyed it up there, made a great network, and actually stayed up there for my first job. This is a little known fact about me that I probably shouldn't be sharing, but I actually spent a couple of years in a completely different industry before I got into oil and gas and finance. I thought I was going to have a career in the outdoor travel industry, and my summer internships were ski instructor and fly fishing guide and things like that. And I went and I worked for a company up in Pennsylvania that owned and operated a series of outdoor travel and hunting and fishing lodges, high-end hunting and fishing lodges. And I worked for them for a couple of years managing their Yucatan, Mexico fly fishing program. But anyhow, I could go down that rabbit trail, and it's a passion of mine, spending time in the outdoors. But I decided making, you know, $27,000 a year probably wasn't gonna cut it long term. And I kind of shifted to being a consumer of that industry as opposed to working in it. Came back down here to Houston and talked my way into a banking job at Jefferies. I don't know how. I was analyst number two when Jefferies was still Randall and Dewey, a division of Jefferies, right after the acquisition. Spent 5 really cool years there, as I mentioned, as analyst number two. And so I was given a lot more responsibility than I deserved. And we got to work on some really, really cool transactions with some great people, which was a, you know, big launching pad for me and in energy and finance. And did that for 5 years in Houston, spent a year in London with our international team. And then I went and I got my MBA out in Austin at UT 2010 to 2012. And that's when I got into private equity. I joined a firm called Haddington Ventures, a midstream fund. Spent 5 really, really interesting years there. I really enjoyed spending time in the midstream. When I was at Jefferies, primarily upstream experience, but it was cool working in midstream. You know, it's important to look upstream and downstream. And it really gave you a, you know, good perspective on the entire value chain, which I really enjoyed. There for, as I mentioned, for 5 years, working on a variety of different assets. We did a lot of green and brownfield development of subsurface storage, which was kind of weird and cool. We built a lot of primarily salt dome based cavern storage facilities, liquids, gas, petroleum.
Yeah, I remember when Mexico opened up to the private sector and I had kind of launched that region for Energy Council. And I remember someone from Haddington Ventures coming down because the kind of underground storage was a potential theme on the midstream investment side for a bit in Mexico. And I don't know if Haddington ever did anything, but when I looked at your CV and saw you at Haddington, it kind of, I hadn't thought of them since probably 16, 17 when I was down in Mexico. So
I'm wondering if it wasn't Chris Meshack.
I think it was. Yeah.
You know, it's funny because he works here now.
Yeah. Small world.
I hired him a couple of years after coming over, but really enjoyed the midstream phase and enjoyed, you know, building some of these larger facilities. 2017, Dan and Walker called me up and asked me to come over and join them, you know, as part of the private equity group. At that point in time, we were still the asset management arm of Tudor Pickering Holt & Company. So came over, joined the team. You know, we were doing some different stuff at that point in time. We had a series of co-investment funds making non-control equity investments alongside, you know, midsize and some larger sponsors. We had a couple of SMAs with some big Texas-based institutional investors. And then we had another kind of commingled fund, and that's kind of wound down. But We did that for, you know, the couple of years that we were still a part of TPH. In 2019, we made the decision to spin the business out. As you know, TPH and Perella had combined at that point, and they wanted to go public. We elected to stay private. And so me, Dan, and Walker, and 10 others lifted the business up out and stood up Pickering Energy Partners in 2019 as a, you know, employee-owned principal investing business, which is all we were doing at that point in time, a series of public and private strategies, Dan running the public strategies, and I, over time, kind of moved into a leadership role running the private strategies. So it's been busy since then, both in our private equity group and across the firm. You know, we were 13 folks focused only on principal investing at that point in time. Now we're 60. We've added on several new divisions. We have an advisory group now. We have a consulting group now. And we have a research business as well. We've also bulked up the public equity side of the house. We merged with a business called Sailing Stone. Really, really smart group of guys that have been doing public natural resources, including energy. Super, super smart group. You know, funny, we did business with Sailing Stone all the way back to when Dan was running the research business at TPH, right? That's how Dan and Walker ultimately developed the relationship with those guys. And so we've known them for a long time, had a lot of respect for them. And during 2020, you know, when things were real rough for everybody, it made sense for us to kind of come together and join forces. Don't quote me on exactly when that transaction got done, but it was hatched in 2020. And I think it was completed either, you know, later in 20 or early 21. But that's been a, you know, fantastic relationship and kind of joining of forces. Again, we overlap a lot on the type of assets that we're interested in, the type of risks we try to understand. And Ken and his team, or you know, Ken and McKenzie and their team have been such an additive group for our horsepower. We compare notes a lot. We talk to their clients, they talk to ours. McKenzie was down and gave a really, really cool presentation at our annual meeting a couple of weeks ago on his energy transition points of view and kind of how he thinks about the copper markets, right? Because they've got a really cool energy transition strategy, but it's not tech risk, right? It's energy transition their way. It's natural resources focus in way to play that trend. So yeah, so we've been in rapid growth mode. You know, we've kind of replicated the, you know, the boutique energy focused financial services and principal investing model that Dan and Walker are very, very familiar with, off and running, which has been really, really cool to watch. You know, it's we in the private equity group, you know, for the most part have been head down with a couple of strategies that we're focused on. It's been a wild couple of years on that front as well, but it's been really cool to watch them put this business together in the way that they have.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to Opportune LLP for sponsoring our Minerals and Royalties podcast. As a leading global energy business advisory firm, Opportune is well positioned to provide world-class technical, financial, and operational capabilities to minerals and royalties companies. Whether it's back office outsourcing, resource and reserve definition, land due diligence and administration, GIS mapping, valuation work, data and system integration, financial reporting, tax advisory, or buy and sell side assistance, Opportune LLP has got you covered. For more information, please visit www.opportune.com. Is your team interested in de-risking their underwriting on minerals acquisitions? What about maximizing the value of your minerals on exits? Source Energy is pioneering energy intelligence to help you stop guessing when, where, and if wells are going to be drilled and completed on your minerals. If you're interested in tracking daily frac crew activity, buying white space before permits are filed, buying permitted acres just before the rigs show up, buying minerals at permit pricing when drilling is in progress, buying ducks with imminent flush production, or maximizing the value of your permits and ducks anytime you exit your minerals, then please visit www.sourceenergy.com/minerals or email info@sourceenergy.com for a free demo. I also want to say thank you to Noble Royalties, who's been a leader in the minerals and royalty space since 1997. With the ever-changing landscape of the energy industry, Noble's team urges EMPs, mineral funds, and private families to rethink how they buy and sell their minerals. Noble's legacy and experience will assist in delivering effective solutions to EMPs and private owners alike on how to best maximize their mineral ownership in this ever-changing market. If you're interested in having a conversation about what might be the best solution for your company, fund, or family, then please reach out to Chase Morris at cmorris@noblerroyalties.com or Shannon Manor at smanor@nobleroyalties.com.
Yeah, so within the private bucket, do you back teams at all? Is it primarily a non-op strategy? You mentioned a TPH asset management. You guys were doing a lot of co-invest vehicles and you had partnerships with institutions. And it sounded, you said non-controlling, so it sounded like drill co's or some sort of non-op play. What is the strategy and what have you guys done to date out of your private equity bucket?
Yeah, and so to clarify on the co-invest front, we were non-control equity investors, right? So we would do a deal alongside Apollo. We'd be a small check alongside Apollo. But again, we ultimately transitioned away from that and kind of stood up what we call our upstream direct strategy in 2019, as we, you know, our read of the tea leaves said it was going to be a good moment in time to spend, you know, to spend some time focused on the upstream. And what that's grown into is we have two strategies as part of that upstream directs platform. We have a PDP strategy and we have a drilling strategy. And both are focused on taking non-operated working interest positions alongside great operators in better parts of the basins. So you said, do you back teams? We do, but not in the traditional sense of backing a team. We don't put together LLCs and sit on boards. We certainly have experience doing that and can. We've just preferred to focus on these non-operated partnerships as a you know, our kind of, you know, method for building these partnerships. And there's several advantages that we've really, really enjoyed about investing in that way at the asset level, being JOA investors as opposed to LLC investors, we sometimes call it. Number one, it gets us access to some teams that aren't interested in having private equity capital in their capital structure on their board. When we come in at the asset level, we come together and make a plan and we have some say in how that specific asset is managed. But a lot of these businesses, Henry Resources is a really good one. They've been around for 50 some odd years. Mr. Henry's been wildly successful and he's not interested in having somebody like myself, you know, sit on his board and you know, tell him what to do with his business. And I get that, right? And so that's, but we built several partnerships at the asset level where we all kind of have an understanding and we do have a little bit of say in how we, you know, and how the capital is deployed, timelines and so on and so forth. And it's
so how does that look? Is that like an AMI that you guys jointly develop? Is it just AFE buying? What type of asset level structures are you guys setting up?
It can be. So, and we can do all of the above, right? So a lot of the assets that we bought. So we set this strategy up in 2019. 2020 was a lost year. We tried our darndest to get deals done, made a lot of shots on goal, were unsuccessful. 2021, the dam broke and we got 7 deals done across our PDP fund and our drilling fund, all of which were with Henry Resources, and then one of which was with a company called Panathon Petroleum. And all of those deals were more or less farm-ins or acquisitions with which we walked into the room kind of shoulder to shoulder with our operating partner. You know, we put in a good bit of the money. They put in a substantial amount as well, and which is important to us from an alignment perspective to make sure we all want the same thing and have a good bit of capital on the line to get there. That's how those investments were kind of launched and built.
Out of the PDP bucket, it was very much kind of acquisition financing then.
Yeah, right. So one of the neat tools about having two different pools of capital and thinking about the upstream industry is really having two distinct asset classes, producing wellbores that are lower risk and lower return assets. And then you got to go and buy leasehold and drill wells too, or you can. And that's a higher risk, higher return proposition. We can use our PDP money independently. We can use our drilling money independently, or we can use them in concert. You know, what we call match cost of capital. And so one of the things that's nice about having a PDP fund today is the lack of debt financing that's available. We can be, you know, de facto debt financing if you want to think about it that way, right? So if you're a management team and you need to go make a 25% rate of return to hit your incentive waterfall, and you want to go buy something with a bunch of PDP assets on it that somebody's going to want PV13 for, then that's dilutive to your ultimate goal. And so that's where we can come in. We have dollars that are perfectly happy to take that return profile. It's designed to take that return profile. And so we can, quote unquote, as you put it, finance that part of the acquisition and let your dollars flow towards buying leasehold drilling wells, the higher return proposition stuff. So you hit your targets as well.
Have you guys explored override financing? Not too far of a distant cousin from what you're talking about on the debt side, no?
You know, we haven't. We love the override space. You know, we love the mineral space, but it is a different animal in some ways, right? I think that there are some similarities to non-op investing, But I think the one key difference in the way that we invest in non-op versus buying minerals or overrides is that we always have to have some way to create a definitive timeline, even though we don't have control, right? So we go buy an asset with Henry, but we're non-op, you know, we're non-op to in the asset, but we know what the drilling schedule is. We know when they're going to drill the wells. And that way, you know, we can be IRR focused, which a lot of our investors are. You know, in the mineral space, you know, creating that definitive timeline can be very, very difficult. We've tried to buy a bunch of different minerals packages, and we're always wide of the number because our analysis will give credit for locations that are part of what we would call a definitive timeline. And the rest, we just kind of have to say it's not valuable to us. And the seller says, well, heck, I'm not selling that. I'm not selling at that number. You got to give me credit for those locations. There is money out there that will, right? But it's money that wants, you know, that is a, you know, stick it in a drawer for 10 or 15 years and just make sure it's a 3X, right? And they're less IRR focused.
Yeah,
those wells are going to get drilled. It's just when.
Yeah, yeah. That comes up from time to time is really minerals investing, at least in longer term strategies, needs to be a yield oriented perspective, and working interest investing is IRR driven. And when you try to blur those lines, it can be misleading from a metric standpoint, right?
Yeah, the same reason we're no good to buy scattershot non-op across 15 different operators. And there's some really cool assets that we've seen. We worked one earlier this year that was a great asset, but we missed by a mile because we can give credit for, you know, ducts, you know, wells that are in process being drilled. Maybe even think about permits, although those don't always convert. But then you look at, you know, the other 60, 70% of the locations that are ultimately going to get drilled over the next 10 or 15 years, we really can't value them.
Fair. So this is one of my questions, and you kind of just answered it. It sounds like you're taking more concentrated positions. So I just did on our new non-op series, I just had Glenn Adams on. He runs StoneTex. They've been investing. He's been investing in non-op going back to the 80s. And he's always wanted control levers in place, sometimes upwards of 50%. And so that's harder to negotiate. It's very relationship driven. And I just had Travis Pace on from Fortuna. They are more diversified, smaller interests. So there's definitely some different strategies. You guys are going more, I mean, you mentioned you've done so many deals with Henry. So what kind of percentage working interest are you taking at the asset level? Are we talking 30, 40%? And then what are the typical check sizes for those listening that may be interested in your model to approach you guys for partnerships?
Yeah, we're not afraid to be quite concentrated, right? And when we, you know, the way that we think about it is, you know, you're going to have a fund with a series of investments that's going to give you diversification across, you know, call it 5 to 8 investments. So within any specific investment, we're not afraid of being concentrated. So we have today $450 million of dry powder across our two funds. Our check size is, you know, I think anything's going to have to be $10 or $20 million for us to work it, but we can, you know, look at deals that are upwards of $100 million pretty easily. And we've actually made some club bids recently on some much larger packages. So we have a solution for just about anything. You get much below, you know, $10 or $20 million, and it's probably not going to be a good fit. We're actually working on a JV with a team that we've known for a long time, have a lot of respect for, that may ultimately try to help us, you know, aggregate some of these smaller deals and be
a feeder, essentially, kind of a
feeder. And they have some unique access to some of the types of deals that we're looking for. But yeah, so on the PDP side, we've fully deployed our first fund, and one of the reasons that we've done so many deals with the guys at Henry. Well, number one, we have a fantastic relationship with them. We've actually manage money for the family for a while in our business. You know, Walker Moody, our president's from Midland, and so he's known Mr. Henry and his family for a long, long time. So we have a great relationship with them. They have a hell of a brand and reputation for being great operators. And the first fund that we launched, the first PDP fund that we launched, was a partnership explicitly with Henry. It was called Henry Production Partners, right? So we were going to obviously do a bunch of acquisitions with them. We're now on to our second fund. It's called our second PDP fund. It's called PEP, PEP, Production Partners 2. And that fund is going to, you know, we'll do deals, and we expect the guys at Henry, as well as other operators in the Permian Basin. We also added two new basins, same general area geographically, because we like being market located, but we can also invest in the Eagle Ford and the Haynesville now. So it gives us a little bit more, a couple more areas to look for deals in. And it gives us the ability to add some gas into our commodity mix, which we like.
And so PEP was launched, I saw the press release July 13th of this year, 2022, and it said you have a strategic partner with an institutional investor. So was this less a commingled fund and more of going back to the TPH asset management days of like a co-invest type structure?
I just walked through kind of the PVP side of the house, right? So in our first fund has a large anchor and probably 15 other institutional high net worth individuals. That's a $225 million fund. Fund two, which we've launched, as I mentioned, is anchored for $150 million by that same large institution. We're not going to go out and try to raise additional dollars until we have a sizable deal done. Blind pool risk is a hell of a thing to market right now. And so, and we experienced that with fund one. And so we're going to go ahead and get a deal done. We've been trying like heck to get one done. It's been tough in 2022, which I'm happy to go into. But when we do, we'll go out and raise additional dollars. Again, I would expect this fund to be 250 to 300, and again be an additional 10 or 15, institutions to round out the PDP fund. The press release that you referenced was on the drilling side, right? We call that DOF, Development Opportunities Fund. Again, a large institutional investor with whom we have a long-term relationship that wants to instead take drilling risk. And so, that's a kind of a separate pool of capital. And again, I refer back to, having independent PDP dollars and drilling dollars is really, really important to how we think about investing.
No, for sure. Now, is that Eagle Ford, Haynesford, Permian as well, or is it just Permian?
That's just Permian. And the investor that we partnered with there, had a specific interest in getting exposure to the Permian. I think, down the road, and again, I want to stress that the number one priority for me and my team right now, finding good acquisition and investment opportunities. We have plenty of capital. We need to go and get deals done. We've made 20 offers this year. It's been a wild market, with oil moving from, 120 range down into the mid 70s over a relatively short period of time. That volatility has made it really hard for sellers and buyers to come together. But again, our number one focus right now is getting deals done. But on the horizon, which you kind of highlighted, there is a hole in our kind of capital availability on the drilling side. And we ultimately want to have drilling dollars available to go and participate in the Haynesville and in the Eagle Ford. But again, baby steps. We have some higher priorities in front of us right now.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to Noble Royalties, who's been a leader in the minerals and royalty space since 1997. With the ever-changing landscape of the energy industry, Noble's team urges EMPs, mineral funds, and private families to rethink how they buy and sell their minerals. Noble's legacy and experience will assist in delivering effective solutions to EMPs and private owners alike on how to best maximize their mineral ownership in this ever-changing market. If you're interested in having a conversation about what might be the best solution for your company, fund, or family, then please reach out to Chase Morris at cmorris@nobleroyalties.com or Shannon Manor at smanor@nobleroyalties.com. Predicting operator behavior is the name of the game in the mineral space, but using permits and rig locations alone to do this is not enough. Detecting well pads and frack ponds in order to see which permits are on the rig schedule, discount permits that won't ever be spudded, and determine which ducts are next up on the frack schedule is key to de-risking your underwriting. By using satellite imagery and AI, Source Energy shows oil-filled well pad construction before permits are filed, shows frack pond filings even before the crew arrives, and shows pinpoint frack crew movements daily, so you can get ahead of drilling activity and completions. If you're interested in leveraging this technology to revolutionize your ground game, then please feel free to visit www.sourceenergy.com/minerals or email info@sourceenergy.com for a free demo.
Need energy industry management experience at your fingertips? Opportune LLP, a leading global energy business advisory firm, has the capabilities needed to overcome your minerals and royalties team's technical, operational, and financial challenges. To learn more, search Opportune's podcast E2B, Energy to Business, on Apple and Spotify Podcasts, where Opportune examines emerging financial and technology trends and provides a broad perspective on ways to stay ahead, create opportunities, and execute market strategies. For more information, please visit www.opportune.com.
So on the topic of kind of going out and fundraising, how have you guys found the educational process and the discussion with institutions around the non-control aspect? I think the education curve that folks like myself, Carver and Sicky, and all the, my peers in the mineral space continue to work on every day is defining the minerals and royalties asset class and its characteristics and all that. And the fact that it's non-cost bearing is a mitigating factor to the lack of control, right? Because if things go awry, you're not on the hook for dollars. In non-op investing, you continually get jibbed. And with rising and falling commodity prices and service costs and inflation and all that, you know, all that gets baked in. When you're raising money for these drilling funds and the PDV fund for that matter, because they're both non-op, how do you get institutions comfortable and get their heads to wrap around it? What are the common things that come up that you can kind of address with the historical track record and I guess misconceptions as well that maybe they're incorrect about and you have to educate them on?
You know, it's interesting. And we do have a concentrated LP base and a lot of them are fairly sophisticated. And so you can get deep into the weeds in terms of explaining how you can kind of recreate, you know, synthetic control, you know, through a non-op asset. So, and I already touched on this, it starts with long-term partnerships with operators. You know, we're not going to do anything with somebody we don't have a good long-term relationship with that doesn't have a track record, you know, for doing things and doing things the right way. You know, the second thing is alignment. The folks that we've partnered with to date have put in an incredible amount of capital, you know, far in excess of where you would typically see, you know, a private equity sponsored team putting dollars in. So, and Henry's a really unique example, right? So we're kind of 50-50 across most of what we do together, right? They're half the capital and they have ultimately the same goals as us. If they're drilling bad wells, they're not going to keep calling their own money to drill bad wells, right? And sure. So we take a lot of comfort in that alignment. We also have, you know, we have an open line of communication. And, you know, I think that we have a great working relationship about, you know, what's going on with, you know, the cost to drill wells, how much oil and gas and NGLs the wells are making, whether we like that, right? And whether we, you know, we should be doing things differently. And when we set up on the asset, we had a drilling schedule. Things change, they move around a little bit. But I tell you that, you know, we feel like we have, you know, kind of recreated synthetic control over these deals such that we're not doing our diligence, making an investment and then rolling the dice and hoping things happen how we expected them to. And again, you know, back to the definitive timeline comment that I made, that's why we don't do scattershot PDP. That's why we typically whiff on minerals acquisitions because we can't pay for the stuff, you know, over the horizon. And again, those points have resonated with our LPs, right? And there's a flip side to it, right? So if I'm going to go back a team to go do something in the Permian and it's a high quality team, I'm going to have to pay them $3-5 million a year. And if you put $50 million to work and you have that much annual cost drag, that's why all these teams got smash cut. That's why the model has changed, right? Part of the advantage is cost avoidance. And again, it takes a little bit more finesse and patience to find teams that don't need a paycheck. Because that's effectively what we're saying, or already have a source of income from typically a legacy set of assets or a legacy business. But that, you know, that cost avoidance is extremely valuable.
But, you know, when you are in the Midland circles and, you know, you're dealing with teams in the Permian, you do have folks that have done very well and are willing to forego that upfront cost for upside sharing. And then again, that goes back to alignment. So all that makes sense. It's just, as you mentioned, a little bit of a shift in the model, at least where you guys are gravitating towards the early days of the shale boom, where you had these very, very young first-time management teams. You're looking more to the other side of the spectrum for experience and track record and long-existing relationships. And that all makes sense.
And the last point I would make, which is important to understand, is if one of our partners went crazy and started behaving in a way that we didn't want to deal with anymore, we would non-consent all the wells and sell our working interest and get on down the road, right? And at that point in time, you know, we're very focused on low entry cost, right? So we're not going to go and be the guy who's paying $20,000 an acre to get a hold of something. You know, I think the highest number we've paid thus far is, you know, maybe $3,000 or $4,000 an acre. Vast majority of the money that we're putting into these deals is the cost to drill the wells. And so if that's the case and something goes sideways, I've drilled wells, they're now producing wells, which are fungible. I can go and call up EnergyNet, have them sell those wells for me, sell the remaining leasehold interest, cut bait and run, right? And live to fight another day. So again, that's kind of the full picture on how we think about, you know, when we go to committee and Dan's like, all right, what happens if this goes completely sideways? You know, are we, you're not stuck, right? You have a, you have a vendable asset and you, you walk, which knock on wood hasn't happened to us.
Well, that's a perfect transition into my final question for the episode. You mentioned earlier that you guys are in talks with a potential JV for kind of a feeder, a lower market aggregator that can pool not up to the scale of where it's interesting for you guys. You see this, this is why my firm exists, right? In the mineral space, there are so many different layers and folks are competing on deals and doing deals together in the same week, it seems. So there's relationships are so important in the mineral space. For non-op, I know for a longest time, it was purely on the underwriting and, there, and the, you know, wellhead economics. There was no real way to think about an exit because that market wasn't there. So you're starting to have the end buyer market be established, the rises with ABS and NOG and, you know, Granite Ridge just went public. And then you're talking about kind of these aggregators. I think a lot of folks in the mineral space are starting to do both opportunistically, non-op and minerals. It's the reason I'm starting this non-op series on my minerals podcast, right? So from your seat and your firm seat, how have you seen the development of that ecosystem and how has that affected how you go about building a portfolio and going about your strategy?
Yeah, no, it's exciting to see the space getting more attention. I'd be lying if I said that that was ultimately where we were thinking about selling our assets into. Would it be great if NOG came and paid us a big number for our portfolio? Yes. You know, might that happen? Yes. But when we underwrite, we're pretty conservative in terms of how we think about exiting, right? So when we buy a PDP well, we assume we're going to hold it for, you know, for 10 years and sell the stub, or hold it for 7 years and sell the stub, right? And if you look at a 2-year-old horizontal well, you buy it for whatever PV13, PV15, which is nuts to say, right? We're in this new weird world where you can say PV13 to PV15 on PDP wells. Whereas I remember, I still remember being an analyst working for Ralph Eads, and you know, PV10 was how you did PDP, but here we are. Which is one of the reasons we love the risk profile. But we buy a well, we hold it for 7, 8, 9 years. If you've gotten the vast majority of your cash on cash return out of that well, and then you sell the stub, right? So you know, we're looking to do 1.5x to 1.6 is what we're targeting in our PDP funds. About 1.2 or 1.3 times of that return profile has already come out of the well, you know, in the source of, you know, cash flow, which is why the asset class is pretty cool. It sells itself one barrel at a time, whether you like it or not. And so might we roll up all of our PDP wells into an exit to NOG or somebody bigger? Yes. But that's how we think about underwriting. On the drilling side, we're going to buy a finite number of locations, right? Everyone's aware of the fact that, you know, drill the corners and flip acreage value is a bygone play in the industry right now. And so we'll go and buy 15 locations, make a plan to turn all of those 40% rate of return locations into 13% cash flow. That's the value proposition. You do that over a 3-year period, and now I've got, and point forward from there, all I really need to do is call up EnergyNet and sell my non-op interest in these 13% rate of return point forward cash flows, and I've done my 2x or my 2.5x or whatever I'm targeting, right? It's a pretty boring expectation that we have in exiting the deals that we do, but I think it's the one that you need to have. Because the sizzle, you know, fireworks exit, you know, isn't something that anyone I think should be expecting when they underwrite today. Now they happen, right? We just sold a deal with the guys at Panathon. You know, we did that in a year, right? We didn't have to draw all the locations. We got paid for the acreage value. Yay. It was a great outcome. But and that'll happen, right? But we like to think of it in a really boring, conservative way as we buy stuff. And then if we have a win to the upside, great. But I think it's good for the industry. I don't know if we wind up with 5 Northerns in 5 or 10 years. Obviously, you point, you know, the Grey Rock guys now Granite Ridge are out there, and you know, they're another. I expect there'll be another aggregator. But we'll see. It's certainly good for what we're doing, and it's, you know, exciting to see, you know, another kind of leg of the industry, you know, get more popular.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how non-op defines itself over time. I think mineral space really fights hard to carve out minerals in the investor world as its own asset class versus E&P. I think in the public equities market, there's still some battling going on there. And I just wonder in between E&P and minerals, if non-op gets its own lane, or it gets lumped in with E&P or lumped in with minerals for the non-control aspect. But they're all, I think, very different strategies, hence niches set up like yourselves, right? How do you guys manage the downside risk? Do you hedge at the portfolio level? I mean, the one thing that I find amusing is when oil and gas prices run up, everyone in minerals wants to be in drilling deals, right? And, you know, the wellhead returns are so lucrative. But if you get quick reversals, you can really lose your shirt. So, you know, when prices kind of fluctuate a lot and go down, on the mineral side, you're a little bit more hedged in that you can always hold it longer if your capital's patient enough. And you don't necessarily have a destruction portfolio value as rapidly as a non-op portfolio. How have you guys viewed that risk? And again, it goes back to when you're talking with investors, how do you get them comfortable with the lack of control, but then going into periods of volatility?
Yeah, so really there's two primary features to how we think about downside risk. And I'll say we actually just did a presentation on some of this and cycles and how we think about them at our annual meeting. And you know, we spent a lot of time communicating how we think about cyclical risk and how we manage it. And it's really twofold: hedging and capital structure. Those are the biggest levers I think our industry has to pull in general, right? So on the PDP side, we hedge everything when we buy it for 3 to 4 years, 70 to 80%. We've been pretty boring recently, just using swaps, although we look at all of it. And we have consultants that know a lot more about that market than we do, help us not get our faces ripped off when we go to put trades on. But we like to, if we buy something at PV14 and we hedge it for 4 years, you know, we hedge 80% of production for 4 years, we're gonna have a really hard time not making a mid-single digits return, even if prices crater and stay there for a long period of time, which is kind of how we stress our assets when we buy them. Because the one thing that we've told our investors that we're not going to do with their, you know, with their PDP dollars is lose any money. We're going to do everything in our power to ensure that we're not going to lose any of their money. And so we hedge everything and we don't use any leverage. We have the ability to, but we haven't yet. It's just particularly on the PDP side, it's not that powerful when you're dealing with lower returns and now a rising interest rate environment. You're not getting that mm-hmm. much leverage from a, you know, an RBL or whatever. And so is it?
Well, the equity ends up working for the debt. It becomes upside down. So it makes no sense, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then on the drilling side, again, we like to hedge as we deploy capital, right? And so we have what we've been doing is when we drill a well, when we start drilling a well and you're obviously writing, you know, a third to half the checks in the AFE at that point in time, we'll put a tranche of hedges on before we start production. But we're going to move 2 to 3 years out the timeline, right? So if this is, you know, turn to sales date, we'll move a month, 2 months, 3 months over here to give ourselves time cushion. And if, you know, if this is the curve, we'll come down beneath it and only hedge a third of the expected production for a 3 year period. So we're trying to, and we'll continue that process probably in 3 or 4 stages as we deploy capital through the drilling and completion phase until, you know, once the well comes online and we kind of declare IP and we understand the production profile, we'll bring it all the way up to, you know, a 70 or 80% hedged type of number. Again, our goal there is to pair hedges with capital deployment. If we like the return at the price that we're seeing at that point in time, then lock it in, is our philosophy. And then don't use leverage, right? To your point, you're gonna withstand just about anything except, you know, Armageddon if you don't use leverage, right? And, you know, are our winners as fantastic as others that do use leverage? No, but again, one of our kind of 10 commandments here is don't lose people's money.
With the amount of hedging you're using, you haven't looked at asset-backed securitization?
Or we have. We absolutely have. Again, it's not been a priority for us or a value driver in the way that it has been for others. And so, again, we haven't seriously looked at it. You know, we've talked to a lot of people about it. We understand it. But again,
my deduction would be, given your strategy of less partners, you know, more concentrated positions, you may get dinged on any type of rating for diversification, and as a result, it may be less attractive for a portfolio like y'all's, right? Would be my guess.
That's another fair point. Again, you know, we try to be as boring as possible and how we think about, you know, managing risk and delivering a, you know, intended return. The ABS market's been great for some folks. It's just not somewhere we focus as much.
Awesome. Well, Lex, thanks again for coming on. It was really good to dive into the weeds a bit on what you guys are doing, and look forward to keeping in touch a little bit more as I've expanded my platform into non-op in addition to minerals. So enjoy the holidays when they get here, and I'll hopefully see you at one of these holiday parties coming up.
Yeah, I'm sure I will. Enjoyed it, Tim. Always a pleasure.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to this episode of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed. The Minerals and Royalties podcast is meant for informational purposes only. Tim Powell and the Minerals and Royalties Authority are not promoting any specific securities or investments, nor are they providing any type of investment advice. If you enjoyed the episode, then I encourage you to tune in more and also check out the Minerals and Royalties Authority YouTube channel. Thanks, and see you next time.